Holding Out in Baghdad. Today, Friday, July 25th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. ISIS is creating havoc in Iraq. People are fleeing their homes. Our friend Sahar thought she might flee too, but for now, she's standing her ground.
I lived in Iraq and I worked in Iraq and I raised a family in Iraq. I don't want to be chased out of my home.
Also today, a Bavarian prince on the merits and dangers of jousting.
If you make a mistake with a lancer, if you make a mistake with a squad, you can chop someone's head off very easily.
Do not try that at home. Plus, a new dinosaur find that might help answer one of the big questions in life.
Just how deep does birdiness go in evolutionary terms?
Birdiness? Yeah, birdiness.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Put a lid on the violence first, and only then sit down and talk about the larger problems. That's what John Kerry is trying to do in the Middle East. Nearly 3 weeks into Israel's military campaign in the Gaza Strip, the Secretary of State is looking for a way to stop the fighting. But anger about the deaths of Palestinian civilians in Gaza is spilling over to the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Five Palestinians were killed there today during protests. Shira Frenkel is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed, and she says tensions in the West Bank have started to boil over.
Yesterday saw the largest demonstrations that the West Bank has had in over a decade. People here are telling us over 30,000 people came out and marched on Qalandia. That's the main checkpoint between Jerusalem and Ramallah. When I walked through that area, you could just smell the sort of charred remains of Molotov cocktails that had been thrown. There were rubber bullet casings everywhere, and it was clear that it had been a very, very violent night.
We are hearing again talk of a third intifada, but, you know, some West Bank Palestinians have said that for years. Is there a sense now that something is different, that we could actually be heading for another big uprising?
You know, as you said, we've heard about a third intifada time and time again. The feeling is that, yes, definitely people are angrier now than they have been before, and that anger is coming from two places. Anger at the Israelis for their ongoing military campaign in the Gaza Strip, but also it's anger at the PA, at the Palestinians' own government. They're saying that the PA has been complicit with the Israelis, that by not standing up earlier and condemning what Israel was doing in Gaza, the PA basically gave them free rein. Up until now, there have been attempts at protests, at solidarity protests by Palestinians living in the West Bank, and the PA has shut all of those down and not allowed Palestinians there to come out and sort of express their views on what's happening in Gaza. So people are saying that this time around it could be what we'd like to say is an intifada, but it also could be something very different. It could be Palestinians stepping up and rebelling against their own elected officials.
So in essence, anger at the PA or Palestinian Authority is sort of tamping down, in a way, anger at Israel.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when I went to the funeral today of one of those who was killed last night, just as many people told me that they blamed the PA as people who told me they blamed Israel.
So, Shira Frenkel, as for John Kerry's efforts to get a ceasefire going, what is he trying to do at this point, and what are its chances?
I would say the chances aren't great. Both the Israelis and the Palestinians have managed to leak to reporters, almost simultaneously, actually, that they're not interested in John Kerry's ceasefire agreement and that both sides have serious objections to it. So it's not looking hugely hopeful at the moment that his proposition, which is that Israel continue some of its military activity in the Gaza Strip while scaling back activity in the parts of Gaza City where people have taken refuge, it doesn't seem like that deal is going to be accepted anytime soon.
Shira, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the goal of this operation in the Gaza Strip was to take out these tunnels that Hamas apparently uses to sneak into Israel. Is that still what's going on? Has anything changed?
I think it's expanded far beyond that at this point. I mean, the tunnels themselves, Israel initially said that there was about a dozen tunnels. We're now hearing there could be 20, 30 tunnels. So the tunnels themselves are much more complex, much more elaborate than Israel had expected going into this. But Israel's forces have already moved far beyond those tunnels. We've seen them operating deep into the Gaza Strip, nearly 3 or 4 kilometers past where they say those tunnels are. And it seems as though now their mission is much more to deal a blow to Hamas to create a sort of lasting blow that will stop that Islamist group from firing rockets on Israel again. At least that's what we're hearing from intelligence, Israeli intelligence experts who are on the ground. Publicly, Israel has not commented on what the missives of its given to its army are at the moment, but we can see by what they're doing inside Gaza that they have moved beyond the tunnels.
BuzzFeed's Shira Frankel speaking to us from the West Bank. Shira, great to hear from you as always.
You too, Aaron. Great to speak to you.
There's not much talking going on between Palestinians and Israelis right now, not at the official level or any other level, really. Tensions are just too high in the region, and there are so many barriers there. But outside the region, there are some opportunities, small ones, for dialogue. Lauren Ober of station WAMU in Washington, D.C., has one example.
What time do you want to leave?
It's a little after 7 a.m., and Yohanatan Toker is making some breakfast sandwiches. One for himself and one for his housemate, Hamza Awadi. Both men are a little bleary-eyed. Neither has had his coffee yet. Awadi quickly fixes that. As the bread toasts and the coffee brews, their attention turns to the news. The fighting between Israel and Hamas is all they can think about lately.
This is just unbelievable. What is Hamas going to get?
This breakfast conversation about the news isn't so unusual, except for the people who are having it. Toker, who's 28, is an Israeli military officer from Jerusalem. Awadi is 24 and a Palestinian peace activist whose grandfather was a Fatah official. Back home, these two wouldn't interact like this. They'd probably never meet. And yet, here they are making coffee and sandwiches.
Let's have breakfast.
Toker and Awadi are part of an unusual internship program in Washington, D.C. called New Story Leadership. It brings emerging Israeli and Palestinian leaders to the U.S. to work at organizations that represent different sides of the debate. But there's a twist. Participants are placed at organizations representing the other side. Awadi, the Palestinian, works at Americans for Peace Now, a pro-Israel group. Toker, the Israeli, is at the American Task Force on Palestine. He says it's been hard.
For me, as a captain in reserve, to come to an office with the flags and the maps and the opinions, this is a daily struggle. And this is me getting out of my comfort zone, but this is the choice that I made.
Part of getting out of that comfort zone is living with Awadi. Up to this point, most of Toker's interaction with the other side happened during his 5 years as an Israeli military officer.
Growing up, I didn't have the chance to have this kind of discussions or experience with anyone from the Palestinian side.
Awadi has had more experience with Israelis because of his activism. He's from Dura, a West Bank city where an Israeli soldier shot and killed a Palestinian teenager during a raid last month. Awadi has strong views about the conflict, but that doesn't mean he thinks dialogue is impossible.
Changing the narratives is not an option. Everybody believes in their narrative, and it's identity for them. This is who they are. What we are trying to do is trying to agree on the new narrative, the new story, the future, how we want our narratives to continue.
That's hard to do right now with the death toll rising back home. So for now, the two housemates are trying to focus on learning about each other. They've explored D.C. together, monuments, museums, the whole Capitol tourist shebang. Awadi says at this point, Toker feels like a brother.
He respects where he came from, but he still sees the other, and he's interested, and he gave the effort to know what is inside me. And he doesn't take it away. He deals with it. He thinks about it. He asks about it.
For Toker's part, living with Awadi has been critical to the whole experience.
I couldn't ask for a better present for this summer than to meet Hamza and to share our house together, and share dinners and breakfast and laughter and going in the metro together and seeing D.C. together.
The two talk about politics, yes, but they also talk about movies and music and girls. And they're always teasing each other.
Because it's the radio, everybody needs to know that he's just ugly. That's the first thing.
Oh, man, and that's rough.
Yeah. The pair will be housemates for another 2 weeks. Then they'll return to their respective homes, where they hope to continue the dialogue. Given the level of animosity there, that could be a challenge. But right now, from the neutral zone of their D.C. kitchen, the guys say they intend to maintain their friendship.
I hope and I'm sure when we go back, our friendship will continue. And maybe it will be an example for many people to try to deal with the other person as a human.
For The World, I'm Lauren Ober, Washington.
Our next story is about Iran and something we've sadly become used to hearing about, the arrest of foreign journalists. The latest case involves Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post, his wife Yeganeh Salahi, and two others. One person who knows what it's like to be detained in Iran is Hala Esfandiari. She was arrested in 2007 and held in Tehran's Evin prison for 105 days. She's now in Washington, where she works as a scholar, journalist, and writer at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. But she says Jason's arrest definitely brought back some bad memories.
The nightmare of 207 and 105 days solitary confinement came like a movie in front of my eyes. I really started visualizing how surprised he was, how probably frightened he was, and how humiliating it is to be booked into Evin.
Hala, Jason's wife Yeganeh has also been arrested. She's also a journalist. Why would she have been taken, do you think?
I think to bring pressure on him, because I don't see any other reason why she should have been arrested, because her pieces are just like Jason's pieces, very careful and very well thought, so that not to ruffle any feathers inside the regime. I mean, one of her last pieces was July 19. It was on the power outages during Ramadan, which is very normal and nothing unusual. I mean, everybody who lives in Tehran has to cope with power outage, and everybody knows about it. So it's nothing extraordinary and not a cause to be arrested for.
You talked about the horrors of being in Evin prison. Tell us what the situation is like there.
Look, if they put you in solitary confinement like they put me, and I assume Jason must be also in solitary confinement. My cell had two windows near the ceiling which were barred. The lights are on 24 hours a day, and there was a broken sink in the corner of the room and an iron door. And every time you want to use the facilities, you have to knock on the door, and hopefully one of the guards would come. They would bring food three times a day. And if you were on medication, depending on whether they allowed you to have medication or not, they would bring it for you at night. But you are all by yourself, lonely, and you don't know when they will take you for interrogation. And the interrogation is the hard part. The interrogation lasted, at least in my case, 8 to 9 hours a day.
Hala, if you could speak to Jason right now personally, what would you tell him?
It's very difficult. I've never met Jason, so I don't know what type of a person is, but I was very transparent with my interrogators, and I think I didn't have anything to hide from them. And I think, given from what Jason has written, I think he can defend every word that he put on paper. You know, he has to be strong. What they want to do, and that's what they tried with me, to try and break my spirit, and that's what they will do. They try and break Jason, and especially since they have arrested his wife too, and they are not together. The wife is in women ward. So they will go to him and tell him, your wife said this, this, and that, and will go to the wife and say, your husband said this, this, and that. I mean, he should not just believe what they tell him and should do what his common sense tells him to do.
Hala Esfandiari, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. Just imagine you're walking through the jungle. Back in the age of dinosaurs, you come to a clearing, and there you see your favorite dinosaur, say a T-Rex, and it's covered in feathers, blue ones, or maybe pink. Yep, a new find in Siberia raises the possibility that all dinosaurs had feathers, not just the later ones that became birds. You can see an artist's take on that possibility at PRI.org, courtesy of the journal Science. Michael Balter has an article in Science about that new find.
There's a lot of really big questions which this new discovery could help to answer. Just how deep does birdiness go in evolutionary terms?
Birdiness?
Birdiness.
Is that That's a real word?
It actually is a word that I think I kind of made up, but our editors let me get away with that. And birdiness is, in other words, the question is that I raised in the article that I wrote about this was that we know that birds are dinosaurs, but when did dinosaurs start becoming birds? How early did that evolutionary process take place? And there's no sort of clear dividing line between what's a flying dinosaur and what's a bird. But the new discovery indicates that birdiness, as I call it, really probably arose very, very early in dinosaur evolution. And part of the reason that this new discovery is important is that this new dinosaur, Calendodromius, is about as far away in terms of evolutionary relatedness from birds as you can pretty much get. So it implies that maybe even all dinosaurs had feathers going back to the very beginning, or that at least a large number of them did.
So someone's going to have to redo Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park needs to be badly updated. With feathers.
So we're joking here, but are you really saying that Velociraptor and T-Rex might have had feathers?
Absolutely. Well, Velociraptor most definitely did. T-Rex, quite possible. And I think that what's probably going to happen now is that scientists are going to be going back and looking at their specimens and see if they can find signs of these feathers. So it is actually possible, based on this new discovery, that all dinosaurs could have had feathers. And that shouldn't really surprise us, because dinosaurs were trying to keep warm. Dinosaurs were trying to keep their eggs warm.
But if T-Rex was yellow, that's a big deal.
Well, you know, T-Rex had to reproduce. And a male T-Rex that was really multicolored, kind of like a peacock, would presumably have been pretty attractive to female T-Rexes, and therefore would have done better reproductively and helped it to survive.
I don't know. It seems to take something away from T-Rex if it had feathers. I mean, we picture it sort of kind of monochrome and scary. If it were blue and yellow, I think that, you know, it's just not the same animal.
Well, let me put it this way. If you were walking through the jungle or the tropics where T-Rex lived and you saw its big jaws, I think you'd run away no matter what color it was.
Blue, yellow, pink, whatever. You still
Absolutely.
Run.
Absolutely.
Okay. Michael Balter is contributing correspondent with the journal Science. Michael, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Now, if dinosaurs aren't your thing, how about dragons? Admit it, you'd love to don a suit of armor and battle a flying beast, you know, Game of Thrones style. Or how about a joust? Two horsemen ride at each other at full speed, each aiming to ram the other off his horse with a long, pointy lance. You can understand why such a violent pastime was popular in medieval times, and not so much since. You can't do it yourself, but if you really wanted to see jousting, you could this weekend at Kaltenburg Castle in southern Germany. That's where the world's biggest jousting tournament is held each year. Prince Leutbold of Bavaria owns the castle, and thank goodness he doesn't insist that we call him Your Highness or anything like that.
And as you like, totally relaxed.
I asked His Highness how he ended up hosting the festival.
Some years ago, we had the idea to do some kind of a great festival, and we ended up doing a jousting tournament, which has been the best way of entertaining in the medieval times. And we thought it's about time to make that life again, and it was proved to be very successful and opens many opportunities. The tournament we organize with some of the world's best stuntmen. They've been in many films, medieval films, but also James Bond films and whatever.
I'm looking at a picture of what I assume now is a beer hall. You also brew beer there, don't you?
We have a brewery in Kaltenberg, yes. And typically Bavarian, we have a castle with a brewery inside. That's quite common here. Obviously, it fits quite well with a medieval festival to have beer as well.
Yeah, although jousting and beer don't seem like two things that should go together.
No, not at all. It's, and we are very, very strict that all the people who fight don't drink when they go on a horse or don't go drink before they go on a horse because it is dangerous. Even if it's done by stuntmen, if you make a mistake with a lancer, if you make a mistake with a sword, you can chop someone's head off very easily. And so we have to be extremely well-trained and extremely well-organized people. And if someone is disorganized, you can't let them do that sport.
Wait, these are the real things? These are real lances and real swords that these guys are using?
The swords are real swords. They're quite heavy. They train for months to make sure that every fight is extremely well rehearsed and nothing happens. On the lances, you have solid wooden lances, but they're constructed like in the movies. If you hit, they will explode. You shouldn't have any accident, but if you make a mistake, you can easily do anyways.
This is a real castle, right? Is this a place where you
Yes.
live, or is it kind of just a tourist attraction now?
No, it's a place I live. It's not that big. It's originally quite old, but it has been burned down a few times in its history.
Okay.
And so today it's a combination of brewery and living place and restaurants and on.
Okay, if Wikipedia is serving me correctly, you are related over the course of many hundreds of years to Ludwig II. Is that correct?
Well, yes, directly, sure. He was my great-granduncle, so it's not
okay.
that far away.
Right, great-granduncle. So
he had no children, so that's why it's uncle.
Ah, okay.
The last Bavarian king was my great-grandfather.
Wow. So he created one of the most famous castles in the world, Neuschwanstein.
Neuschwanstein, yes.
In Bavaria, and it was sort of the model for the Disney castle. Is that what your place looks like? Those towering
spires?
No, my place
it's much more simple. My place is smaller and much more simple.
It's just a little castle.
Little castle, yes.
So what is the coolest thing about living in a castle?
I don't know if it's cool. It's certainly cold in winter, but if you're used to having more room and more space, it's something which is quite nice and convenient, but it also has its slight difficulties because then you have, you know, a lot of wind going through and it's less easy to heat and on, but if you live in it, it's quite good fun. You know, you can always find the odd ghost somewhere. Maybe it's some animal living in the double floors or so, but it's certainly always excitement.
It's kind of a joke that castles are a little drafty, but it must help just a little bit that you have a brewery there.
It does. In winter, it gives the opportunity. You go down in the cellars, and if necessary, you can, you know, go directly to the tap, to the big tanks, and have a fresh beer, so you can stay Christmas at home comfortably.
Yeah, it's a nice way to start the day, I would think.
It certainly is. In Bavaria, this is not totally uncommon. And white sausage and a beer for breakfast is something which is still practiced in this country quite a lot.
You guys know how to live. Prince Luitpold of Bavaria, a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Aaron.
You can see a video of the jousting tournament at Prince Luitpold's castle. That's at PRI.org. And you are listening to The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. Ahead, what it's like to be Christian in Mosul, Iraq, now that ISIS extremists are in charge there.
Imagine if you drive right now a car, and then I come, I have a gun, I tell you, you are Christian, get out from here. I take your car, I take your money, and then if you come back again, I will kill you for sure.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Any parent would place the safety of their kids first, no question about that. You see that in the desperate decision by Central American parents to send their kids alone to the U.S. rather than have them face the violence of street gangs back home. And you see that now in Baghdad, as you'll hear with our next story. The Iraqi capital has become such a frightening place for families that many middle-class residents who can afford to have felt compelled to send their kids out of the country.
As you can imagine, the absence of children would be painfully obvious during a holiday, and so it is now in Baghdad, as Muslims there and everywhere prepare to end Ramadan with Eid celebrations next week. Sahar Issa is a journalist living in Baghdad and someone we turn to often to talk about Iraq. She says she herself is experiencing a painful void ahead of the Eid holiday.
No one is left. My son has gone. Everyone is gone. Eid is coming. And my mother and I were just sitting over iftar. And she was telling me, Sahar, what do you think we should do for this Eid? We want to have like the same banquet, the same. And I was telling her, mother, there's no one here. You know, banquet for whom? You know, and, they're and all gone.
You mean Eid for the end of Ramadan?
Yes, of course. Eid for the end of Ramadan is a time of festivity for all, of course, Islamic people, Muslims, and it's a traditional get-together of families. I mean, that's how it is special. The important thing is that families get together, they have a lovely sort of lunch together or dinner together, and we were talking, usually we have, what, 130 people coming to Eid dinner or lunch? And we were sitting at iftar, and she was telling me, what shall we do? What should we prepare? And my daughter and I were looking at one another and we told her, there isn't anyone here anymore. They're all gone. Everyone who can leave has left. We have gone to the travel agencies and spoken to them. I actually asked. And as we were sitting there, people kept coming and going, requesting visas, etc., etc. Reservations are 1 month and a half gone.
Sahar, if I may ask, why are you still there? Why haven't you left?
When I was young, I was living in England, and London was my home in Grandison Road in Battersea. I can see the stores, the shops, the public library. That was my home. When I came back to Iraq, my heart was still there. I lived in Iraq, and I worked in Iraq, and I raised a family in Iraq, and this war comes along. Okay, and everyone is leaving Iraq, and I thought I would be the first to go because, you know, I have another home, or at least I have a feeling of another home. But you know what? This is my home. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to be chased out of my home. My son is in danger. I have to send him away. If my daughter is in danger, I have to send her away. If I had a brother, if I had a father, if I had a husband, all these people would be in danger. They would need to go away. But I don't want to be chased away. I want to stay here. I want to do what I can. This is not rhetoric. I can leave. I can pick up and go. It's not easy. We are not allowed as Iraqis. No one gives us visas. So we can't really go very far, but at least we can go. But I don't want to. I want to be here.
Sahar, as hard as it is now in Baghdad and in northern Iraq for everybody, it's become especially tough for Christians these days. Do you know of any families, do you have friends who are coming down from places like Mosul?
My daughter, during the past 2 years, was tasked to do her, she's a dentist, to do work in Hamdaniya, in Qaraqosh, in the heartland of Christendom inside Iraq, to the north of Mosul. And she was there until maybe 2 weeks ago when she came home.
Okay.
She was there when bombardment took place. She was there when the families came rushing from Mosul and from the other plains into Qaraqosh and into Hamdaniya on their way to Erbil and north to the north. And she has friends there and she has colleagues there. Their homes are gone. The electricity is gone. The water is gone. Her friend called her yesterday and she was crying. She was telling her, our family home in Mosul is gone. It has been taken from them. They are the original residents of this area. That they should be chased away in this manner is horrible. This coexistence, we have lost it.
Sahar Issa is a journalist. She lives in Baghdad. And as we heard, she will stay in Baghdad, at least for now. Sahar, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
One place in the U.S. where Iraqis have been resettling for many years is El Cajon, California. The San Diego suburb has welcomed Iraqis since the 1950s. More than 23,000, mainly Christians, have resettled there just since 2003 and the start of the Iraq War. The new arrivals have built a community of businesses and churches known locally as Little Baghdad. And these days, the hot topic in that community is what's happening to Christians in Mosul. The northern Iraqi city is now under the control of the Sunni extremist group ISIS. And as Valerie Hamilton reports, Iraqis in El Cajon are worried.
Just down the road from the Chaldean Christian Cathedral, Iraqis gather at the outdoor tables of a cafe, sharing news and a game of backgammon in the shade of the palms. It feels like the Middle East, but the cafe is actually a Starbucks. This is Southern California, after all. Today, everyone's thoughts here are on Mosul.
500,000 people in Mosul, Christian, he leave to my cousin. House, car, money, everything, no. He walk.
This backgammon player didn't want to give his name. None of them did. They said they don't trust the U.S. government, but they wanted to intervene, to do something, anything, to stop ISIS.
It's the government and the power of USA to stop them. We are supporting them by supporting them and doing nothing to them.
At another table, I meet Ashraf Abdulahad. He's a Chaldean Christian, born and raised in Mosul, but he came to San Diego as a refugee 6 years ago. He tells me that last week, ISIS fighters in Mosul seized his family's home.
They opened the houses, they broke the doors, they broke the windows, they put their flag on each house, they took it.
ISIS marked Christian houses with an N for an Arabic slur for Christian. Abdulahad learned about it on email and Facebook. Friends were robbed of money, wedding rings, even baby diapers as they rushed to get out of town. His parents were visiting him in the U.S. when ISIS took over, he says. They want to go home, but there's nowhere safe for them to go.
I lose house over there. My dad, he lose his house over there. I lose everything over there. So I don't want to lose my family, too.
Sitting here, sipping coffee outside a California mall, all of this is hard to really grasp. So Abdulahad points at an SUV looking for parking.
Imagine if you drive right now car, and then I come, I have a gun, I tell you, you are Christian, get out from here. I take your car, I take your money, and then if you come back again, I will kill you for sure. They killed a lot. They killed a lot of people from us.
ISIS took control of Mosul in June, and soon after, they started torching churches and destroying ancient shrines. When the attacks on Christians began, Bawai Soro, the Chaldean bishop in El Cajon, was at a religious conference near Mosul. Now, he says, an ISIS ultimatum has Christians there facing a devastating choice.
They gave them three options, either to flee or to convert, basically. And if they decide to be in between, they have to pay an outrageous jizya or tax, religious tax, basically surrendering everything they have.
Soro says that Mosul has a special significance for Chaldean Christians. They've been practicing their faith there for nearly 2,000 years. Now they're gone.
After the first wave of fleeing people, there were only 150 families left. I think now there's maybe like 10, 15 families left from 4,000 families.
Iraqi community leaders in El Cajon are pushing Congress to help Christians and other religious minorities in Iraq. Community spokesman Mark Arabo went to Washington last month to plead their case.
We want to put more pressure to the State Department because Christianity in Mosul is dead.
A congressional resolution he helped write asks the U.S. to negotiate safe passage out of Iraq for displaced minorities and to ease visa rules to allow more of them to find refuge in the U.S. But he says Congress is slow. And ISIS is moving fast. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, El Cajon, California.
Anyone who watches TV soap operas in the Middle East probably knows this voice. It belongs to Jay Abdo, a Syrian actor who starred in many very popular Arabic language soap operas. He's a celebrity in the Middle East, but here in the U.S., where he lives now, very few people know who he is. As Jay Abdo explained to me, he's here because he ran afoul of the regime in Syria.
In the personal level, my life as an actor was good. I had everything I needed, almost. Well, I had a wonderful career. I had great, great friends. But I wasn't totally free. Actually, no one ever felt free in Syria since the 60s, let's say.
Okay, now you said you weren't entirely free in Syria, but you didn't have such a bad life. Why did you decide to start over again and move to the U.S.? How did that happen?
Well, I didn't decide. My wife was already studying here in Minnesota. And at that time, in 2011, children started the spark of our revolution. And I couldn't stand away, so I supported children. I supported the people who went on streets demanding for their universal human rights. And then they started to ask me to appear on TV to embarrass me, to say, to glorify the president, the army, the arrestings, so-and-so, and I couldn't do so. So if you say no or if you don't participate in their actions, you are speaking against of them. So they started to corner me, to harass me, till I spoke up in LA Times in an article accusing the army and the security forces of all what was happening. I went to Lebanon and I met a lady from LA Times. We did a short interview about the entertainment business, and she asked me my opinion about the what's going on, what was going on. And I said, well, I accused the army and the security forces of everything. So things took a very dramatic twist. My life was in danger. So I came to join my wife for 2-3 months and then go back when things went from bad to worse. So I decided to stay.
So you come to the United States. You had a pretty good career back home in Syria. What happens when you get here? Do you just pick up where you left off?
Oh, well, I left everything. I left everything back home. My success, my career, my, let me say, huge name. And, well, I came to a great country. I felt free. I felt safe. But nobody recognized me. For me to start again, I know I speak languages, and I know some people are looking for people with accent like mine, but to find these people is very hard in Hollywood. I started to apply everywhere, volunteer everywhere to start some job just to pay my bills because I couldn't take all my money from my country. So it was very difficult at the beginning. And I knew my break will come one day. I didn't know when, but I believed in that day.
Yeah, talk about big break. Now, just a few years later, you're in a film about to come out called Queen of the Desert. It's written and directed by Werner Herzog, based on the life of Gertrude Bell. In that movie, Nicole Kidman, Robert Pattinson, James Franco, Damian Lewis, and some guy named Jay Abdo.
I can't believe it. I was so lucky.
Did you know who Werner Herzog was?
Of course. Of course. I knew he was big, he was huge, not only for his films, but for his beliefs and for his activism. And I said to myself, being in a movie with him, doesn't matter what role I play, and here I am playing the second biggest role after Nicole Kidman in this epic movie. And I think I was extremely lucky.
The movie that's coming out, Queen of the Desert, was filmed at least partly in Morocco, and there's a really funny story you have about what happened during the filming there with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, so many funny stories. We we were shooting a scene in the street, and people came where Nicole and I in that scene, and some people say, oh, this is Nicole Kidman. And other people, oh, this is Jay. Jay, you're here. And these people, are they fans of yours? I said, yes, I have millions. Oh, good for you, Jay. And yeah, that was very, I mean, for me, emotional to be with such a huge star like Nicole Kidman and to hear this from her. She's such a sweet lady.
Jay Abdo is an actor from Syria, now living here in the United States, and soon to appear on the silver screen in Werner Herzog's Queen of the Desert. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and it's The World on your speakers. What would you say happened to the English language when it came to America? Some Brits might tell you that's when the language started getting fouled up. But they're a minority. Most Brits view the worldwide export of their language as something to be proud of. All this week, the World's language editor, Patrick Cox, has taken us to some of the places in Britain that help set the course for the English language. Today, he takes us to a village in eastern England that played a key role in the establishment of American English.
So just before we visit that village, let me play a clip from a Disney movie, Pocahontas.
What river is this?
Kuyukahanik.
You have the most unusual names here. Chickahominy. Queer-gahonic.
Now, in case you've forgotten your American history, Pocahontas is Native American, and the guy she's talking to is called...
John Smith.
John Smith was a leader of the first English settlement in America, at Jamestown, Virginia. He was born more than 3,000 miles away in Willoughby, Lincolnshire.
In the Baptistry Chapel is basically the life story of John Smith.
David Robinson is the former rector at St. Helena's Church in Willoughby. The church dates back to the 14th century, but there's been a lot of additions in the past few decades. Gifts from a variety of American organizations, stained glass windows, for example, and a plaque that Robinson reads out loud. It details the historical significance of John Smith and Jamestown.
1607, which began the expansion overseas of the English-speaking peoples.
John Smith was a man who wrote a lot of books about his adventures, which started long before he sailed to Jamestown. He fought as a mercenary across Europe, ending up captured in what is today Turkey.
He became a slave, and eventually he killed his slave master, nicked his clothes, nicked his horse, and rode back to England one way and another.
But it wasn't all breathless action. Smith was a great communicator, too.
He would have learned several languages along the way, going up into the Turks, going through France. So when he got to America, to him it was important to learn the local language, and that saved him several times, probably.
The word probably is a useful one when it comes to Smith. We can't verify much of what he wrote, and most historians find his memoirs unreliable. There is, for example, an episode in Turkey in which a girl saves Smith's life by pleading with his captor, just as Pocahontas did a few years later, all of which has given the likes of Disney a conveniently free hand.
This is how we say hello. Wingapo.
Wingapo.
And how we say goodbye. Anna.
I like hello better.
Whether it was through John Smith's flirtations with Pocahontas or other contacts between the settlers and the locals, words from each language were exchanged.
How long do you think it takes for a new variety of a language to evolve once somebody lands in a particular part of the world?
This is linguist David Crystal, co-author of a book about places of significance to the evolution of English.
And most people think, oh, it must take decades, maybe 100 years. It only takes a few weeks before the first signs of this new dialect of English starts to emerge in the letters that these mariners send home to their families. Words like skunk, you know, or wigwam, or moccasin.
Words are one thing, but what about accents? Surely settlers born in England wouldn't speak differently after just a few years in Jamestown.
It does take longer for a community accent to evolve, but not that long. Already in the 1620s and 30s, American settlers coming back to England were being commented on for their accent. You know, people were saying, you know, what a strange way of talking you've got. And so within a generation, enough had changed for it to be a noticeably different way of talking.
A few contemporary accounts tell us this, but of course, there are no audio recordings from that time, so we don't know for sure what English accents sounded like then and how American accents may have diverged from them. Sad to say, we don't get much help from the likes of Pocahontas 2. Yes, there's a sequel.
What do you think of my kingdom?
I think you must be a great king to have so many subjects, Your Majesty, and the loyalty of so many good men.
It's just accepted that in the brief time since she picked up English, Pocahontas has acquired a standard modern American accent. Hearing that, Pocahontas might be turning in her grave. John Smith might be smiling in his, given his predilection for a good story. Smith himself remains elusive. Even the most basic facts about him are unclear, like the day he was baptized. You'd expect his hometown church to have recorded that. And it has, says retired rector David Robinson. But things have become confused ever since those gifted memorials began showing up in the church.
If you look at the register, you look at the window, and you look at the plaque, that's three different actual dates when he was baptized.
A good reminder, if one were needed, that we can be certain of very little when it comes to John Smith and Pocahontas. What we can say is that Smith's arrival in America was a big moment for English. Not that anyone knew it then, but in jumping from a small island to a huge continent, English had gone global, or started to. It had begun reinventing itself with new words, phrases, and spellings. It repeated that trick in places like Australia, India, and Africa, creating not one, but many Englishes, and it's still doing it today. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
To see pictures of Willoughby and all the other places featured in our series on the evolution of English, just go to pri.org/language. And we end the week now with a shining example of how varied the English language has become. It's a tune by Jamaican-born singer Sean Paul. Some people wonder whether his songs are actually in English. They are.
So me go so then, well I don't really care what people say, I don't really watch what them want do, still I got to stick to my girls like glue, and I might not play number two, all I know the time it is getting jet, need a lot of trees up in my head, and a lot of Denzel in my bed to run that real.
That is our show for today. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. And you know what? We don't do this very often. But here's a shout-out to everyone working behind the scenes here in our newsroom. The World is produced by Jeb Sharp and Clark Boyd with Bradley Campbell, Andrea Crossan, Joyce Hackle, Carol Hills, Leo Hornack, Shirin Jafari, David LaValle, April Peavy, Nina Porzuki, Steven Snyder, Tracy Tong, and Chris Wolfe. Our editors are William Troop, Jennifer Gorin, Monica Campbell, Peter Thompson, and yours truly. And The World's engineers include Louis Cronin, Robin Moore, Jane Pippick, and Mike Wilkins. Our managing editor is Jonathan Dyer. The executive producer of The World is Andrew Sussman. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Marco Werman will be your host once again on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.